Good evening and welcome to a one-night stand with the big band. It's a special pleasure for us on a one-night stand with the big bands to introduce Ernest Brooks Wilkins, Jr., better known as Ernie Wilkins. That's quite a handle you go by, Ernie. And I know that's a familiar name to anybody who loves the big bands, an arranger, composer, tenor, and soprano saxophone player. How old were you when you started playing an instrument?
Oh, about 10 years old.
And where were you born?
St. Louis, Missouri.
That's good music country, isn't
it? That's right.
What instrument did you start on?
I started on violin first.
Was that by your choice, or did your parents influence
you?
Well,
my mother bought me a violin for Christmas.
So that's the way it
started. Take it from there.
How long did you stay with violin?
Until I got to high school, and I played violin through my sophomore year. Then I stopped because I became too involved in jazz. Then I started playing saxophone.
Did you take formal lessons on sax?
No, I didn't, except, playing in the high school marching band and the concert band, and we had our own little jazz band that we took upon ourselves to get together. We got no encouragement from the teachers back then. Uh-huh. You know, jazz was somewhat of a dirty word then.
It's a little different nowadays, isn't it, with the stage bands in the high schools and all
yes.
the stock arrangements by, Buddy Rich and everybody else. I'm sure arrangements that you've written for various big bands are now out and available on stocks for these high school bands.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. What saxophone were you playing? Were you an alto or a tenor man or what?
I started out on alto and then I later changed to tenor.
Why?
Well, I liked the sound of the tenor saxophone better, and I was so crazy about Lester Young, who was with Count Basie's band then.
Prez, yeah.
Yeah, Prez. Mm-hmm. And I was also crazy about Coleman Hawkins and all of the great tenor players of that day. And I was intrigued by the sound of the tenor saxophone, more so than alto. Although I loved guys like Johnny Hodges and Willie Smith of the Lunsford Band and of later of Harry James Band. Mm-hmm. But I was just intrigued by the tenor saxophone style and sound, so that's why I changed to tenor.
As a jazz musician, I think tenor, particularly at that time, was more of a solo instrument than alto saxophone, and I see now that you play soprano sax as well, which has gotten to be a great instrument for solos in jazz nowadays.
That's right.
What was the first nationally famous band that you joined?
Even before Count Basie, I was with Earl Hines just for a few months. But the band was on its way out then, and Earl just couldn't get any work for the band. So that's when Earl broke the band up and joined Louis Armstrong's group. But Count Basie's band was really the first.
How old were you when you joined the Count's band?
In my middle 20s.
And who was in his band at that time? Are there names that we would be familiar with nowadays?
Well, I think so. I think most people now are familiar with Clark Terry, the great trumpet player that did Mumbles. He was instrumental in telling Basie about me. And Basie called me up and had me come out to New York. Let's see, we had, I don't know whether there are too many names that people would recognize now that was in that band, but Eddie Jones on bass, who lives here in Connecticut.
Eddie is a great guy, and he was a former guest on this show, and a fine bass player, too.
And let's see who else I can think of. A great lead alto saxophone player by the name of Marshall Royal.
Oh, yes.
And a fine tenor saxophone player by the name of Wardell Gray. He died some years ago, but he was very well known at that time.
Now, you had to be a fan of Count Basie before you joined the band.
I certainly was.
What goes through a young man's mind when suddenly Count Basie calls up and says, like, yeah, I'm interested in having you join my band?
Well, first I couldn't believe it, and it seemed like a dream come true. You know, because I guess as all kids, you know, when you're striving to reach the top, you have dreams. And I used to dream of playing with the big-name bands, and I would go see those bands, and I'd say, oh, wow, I would like to be up there. So that was a dream come true. Wow, I'm going with Count Basie's band. You know, it was those are things that went through my mind. And I was nervous and apprehensive, too.
Once you joined the band, what did you do immediately? Could you handle the whole book without trouble, or does it take some extra work?
I had no trouble. Fortunately, I had the correct background, and I studied and I practiced. And
you could obviously read pretty well.
I could read pretty well because you know what helped me? By playing violin first. That I never had problems reading music, so I was able to handle the book with no problems. And right away, Basie said, "Look, Clark Terry told me that you were quite an arranger. Let's write something, kid." So I started writing for the band.
What was the first number that you did for the Basie band?
Believe it or not, a thing called Bass is Loaded.
Bass is Loaded.
That's my very first.
What did the Count think of it?
Oh, he liked the arrangement. He didn't like the title. You know, here's the funny thing about it. I was thinking about baseball, you know.
Sure.
With bases loaded, two outs, yeah. You know, guy gets up. But Bass say, well, what, Bass is drunk?
What was the first number that you arranged for him that he recorded? I don't happen to remember Basie's Loaded. I don't assume that ever got...
No, it was recorded, but Basie changed the name of it. Oscar Peterson was a guest soloist on it, and it was for Norman Granz's the first label he had. What was it, Nargran? But I don't remember the name that Basie gave to it, you know. But the very first thing that I remember is a thing called bread, mm-hmm. B-R-E-A-D,
bread,
which
yeah.
we call money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Back then we were calling money bread, so that's what I meant, bread. And that was the first thing.
What was the year that you joined the Basie band?
It was May 51. Thank you.
When you joined Basie, this opened up a whole new world for you, a world of travel for one thing.
Yes.
You probably got to see a lot of places that you thought earlier in your life you would only read about.
That's true.
What's your favorite place in the entire world that you've visited? I don't know, maybe it's Milford, Connecticut, because of all the places that you've seen, you selected Milford, Connecticut
to live,
as the place
right?
to live in.
It must be Milford.
Yeah, it's got to be. That says some things the Chamber of Commerce is going to be very happy about there. When did you develop this love affair with the music of Duke Ellington?
Well, it started way back, you know, when my brother and I were kids. And all through high school, but especially in the early 40s, in the middle 40s, when Duke had such great players as Ben Webster, the great Ben Webster, and the great bassist Jimmy Blanton, and Cootie Williams and Rex Stewart, and Tricky Sam Nanton, you know, the plunger trombonist. Mm-hmm. It was during that period that I developed a full-fledged love for Duke and his music. And he also had acquired his right-hand man, Billy Strayhorn. And so it was around, you know, during my college days, and that's when I was doing World War II, you know, when World War II started.
Did you ever aspire to join the Ellington Band?
Oh, yes, I did. I aspired to. I wanted to. But I never thought it could happen. I could never reach that stature.
It was such a hard band to break into because everybody stayed in the band forever.
That's true. Right. The personnel was so constant. You know, it was awfully hard to break into, especially the saxophone section, mm-hmm. you know. But
they played together forever. Matter of fact, you probably heard the story. Charlie Barnett, who probably is the biggest Duke Ellington fan in the world. I remember a few years ago, Barnett has a lot of money, they tell me. And when it became fashionable to put up bomb shelters a few years ago, he had a bomb shelter built behind his home out in Southern California someplace. And the first thing he did was to take his entire collection of Ellington records and put them in the bomb shelter because that, you know, first things have got to be saved first.
I heard that too.
It's a true story, I guess. And he used to like to sit in Duke Ellington's sax section. He's a pretty accomplished musician, but he said it's the most amazing thing to sit in that section and have nothing but goose eggs in the music and hear the section in unison or in harmony playing the most intricate, beautiful things together.
That's true.
So it would have been a very difficult section to break into.
That's right. And whenever a new man did break into it, he had a rough time. It took him a long time to fit in.
I can imagine.
It really did.
I want to know from you, this will be difficult to answer, who's the greatest lead alto man who ever lived? Are you going to say Johnny Hodges, probably?
Well, I didn't look upon Johnny as strictly a lead alto man, although he did play lead, but more so as a soloist, as an outstanding and remarkable soloist.
Frank Sinatra says he never played an untasty note, and
that,
I think pretty well sums
true.
It up.
That's true. That's right.
Yeah. Is he the finest alto man you can recall?
Well, I would say so. There were other alto players that I loved, you know, such as Willie Smith, and Benny Carter and Charlie Parker. But as far as overall musicianship is concerned and great feeling and his super distinctive style, I would say he's the greatest that ever lived.
How about tenor saxophone? You're a tenor man yourself. Was it Coleman Hawkins who was the best?
It's hard to say who was the best. You know, I had a greater love for Lester Young than I did for Coleman Hawkins. But on the other hand, I think I loved them both just as well. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think I could say one was greater than the other because they were both innovators, and they both set two different styles. And so I think they were parallel. I really do.
I have to ask you about another tenor man who unfortunately was killed in an auto accident on his way to a one-night stand. You know I'm going to talk about Chu Berry.
Yes, yes.
I don't know that he was as innovative as the others, and yet I think he was a super tenor man in my mind.
You know what? I think it was an innovator, too. He didn't sound like Coleman Hawkins.
No,
He had that big sound, you know, that big tenor saxophone sound, but he certainly had a different approach. And I think it was on par with Coleman Hawkins.
I'm glad to hear that because Chu Berry has always been my own personal favorite, and I'm glad you brought him up, too.
Yeah. This is amazing. I'm very happy that you did.
Yeah. Okay, how about trombone players? Name a couple of the great ones.
Oh, boy. Oh. Well, Lawrence Brown, for one, out of Duke's band. And a more modern and more younger player, J.J. Johnson. Mm-hmm. There are so many good trombone players. Jack Teagarden I loved. His style was ageless. You know, you could not say he was an old time player. His style was ageless. It sounds whenever I hear some of his solos today, they sound just as fresh now as they did 30 years ago. And that's a mark of a great innovator and a creative person, isn't it?
Yeah, that says it all very well.
Right.
Yeah.
And for plunger work, the old man Joe Tricky Sam Nanton out of Duke's band. There were several fine trombone players I can name. We could go on and on.
It's an endless list.
Right.
Fortunately, because that's what made the big bands. What about trumpet players?
Well, first and foremost, Louis Armstrong. You know, that's without a doubt. He is the father of modern trumpet playing. And I would also say Roy Eldridge and Dizzy Gillespie. And... believe it or not, you might be surprised when I say Bunny Berrigan, but he was different. He had his own way of playing, and even before him, Bix Beiderbecke.
I'm happy to hear you mention that because I hear Bix Beiderbecke solos now, and here's a guy who died many decades ago, and I hear new things in there.
That's right. He was amazing. He was 40 years ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. You know who's when you hear Bobby Hackett.
Mm-hmm.
He's a direct descendant of Bix Beiderbecke, as far as I'm concerned.
Boy, would he be pleased to hear you say that.
And we can get down to the modern players, more modern players, I said Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis before he got into his electronic thing, and my dear friend Clark Terry, who's a virtuoso, and we talked about Charlie Shavers, too.
Charlie Shavers was a highly underrated trumpet
highly
player.
Underrated and highly underappreciated. It's too bad. And I guess I can't leave out my old friend that I used to write for, Harry James. I can't leave him out either. No way in the world I can.
Do you ever listen to big band recordings now? I'm sure you've heard them all 1,000 times over the years.
Yes, I do.
Do you still learn things from them?
Yes, I do. I learn things every day from whatever I hear. I listen to everything that's good.
Mm-hmm.
If it's garbage, I turn off the radio. I don't listen to something else. But anything that's good, and honest, and good, and creative, and done with real sincerity, I listen to and I learn things. That's the great thing about music. You never stop learning.
I think one thing that might be difficult for the young people to grasp. You know, there were no 8-track. Tapes in those days. They didn't overdub. There was no trickery involved. A band sat in a studio and it recorded a 3.5-minute selection. And if it was not perfect, they would just toss the master out and start over again. It had to be perfect from beginning to end. No overdubbing and editing here and taking a note out there and adding an echo effect and so on later.
That's right.
It had to be done perfectly the first time around. The thing that frightens me is to consider the number of great recordings that because somebody in a third trumpet chair goofed half by half a tone or something, the record got thrown out, the solo was never repeated, and we've lost some great music.
That's right.
I wish we'd
kept the file. I hate to think about it.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the bands that you played with. We mentioned Count Basie briefly. Let's talk about Harry James. I know you've done some work for Harry James. You've done some arrangements for him and so on.
Right, right. What I never kind of played with the band, but I wrote for them quite a bit.
Did you have personal contact when you were writing with them? Because that's not necessarily the case. They can tell you what they want arranged, and you can send it back through the mail.
No, I had personal contact.
What kind of a guy is Harry James?
He's okay. He's a very fun-loving guy, you know. But he's also very much a
disciplinarian.
Right. Yeah. As far as his band is concerned, he wants things to be right and perfect. But at the same time, he's not. He doesn't. I never saw him become, you know, overbearing either with his musicians in his band. But he's a fair man, and he's a fine musician. Fine musician.
We were talking a little while ago before we began recording this program about Ted Heath, and I know you did some arrangements for him, but you mentioned that you never met the man.
No, I never did. I wrote the arrangements and mailed them over to England for Ted to use.
How did you get together? Did he make the first overture to you?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he wrote me personally.
He had heard of your reputation then, or heard some of the work that you had done with other bands.
Right.
And did he tell you which tunes he wanted arranged?
Yes, he did.
Did he also relate any instructions to you? You know, I want to go heavy on brass, or my top soloists are, or anything like that?
No, he didn't.
It's completely in your hands.
Completely in my hands. Although he told me who his soloists were, so I would know, you know, where he has the top tenor soloist, or the second trumpet was the top soloist, or the third trombonist was the top soloist. So I would know what parts to put the solo parts, you know, the solos on.
So then he'd say, I want an arrangement of, just to pick one out, Georgia on My Mind.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth do you go about getting the notes on paper for 14 musicians or whatever?
Well, you sit down and just start thinking. That's all you do.
Do you figure out your chords on a piano?
Yeah, sometimes I do, and sometimes I stay away from the piano. I can figure them out in my mind. In fact, most of the things I did for Basie were I wrote while I was riding on the bus, the band bus. And as we would drive down the highway, I'm writing a new arrangement for Basie. So I can do without the piano. But it's more than just sitting down thinking. You just have to use your imagination. And sometimes it's painful. Sometimes you sit there for hours before you can think of anything that you like yourself, you know, that you would write down on paper.
And yet there are probably other times when your pen can't fly fast enough to keep up with what's in your mind.
That's right.
That's interesting.
It certainly is. That's the human mind, you know.
You've mentioned Dizzy Gillespie. I was on stage with Dizzy Gillespie. I emceed a show where he played once. I have never seen anybody do the things with a trumpet that he did absolutely effortlessly. He looked as though he could have played for 24 hours without hurting his lip, and he does amazing things.
Yes, he is. He's unbelievable.
What do you do as far as arrangements are concerned with him?
Well, I have to use a different approach for him, you know, because he's more... You know, in the old days, we used to call his music bebop, and it's a terrible label to put on music, you know, and a lot of people put it down because just of that name itself. Mm-hmm. But it was more modern, more intricate music, much more intricate rhythmically and harmonically, you know. So sitting down to write for Dizzy, you had to think about him and his music, his particular style and his kind of music, and you have to... immerse yourself into what his music is all about. Thank you.
Did you personally like bebop?
Yes, I did.
It never really caught on, even with jazz fans. There was a hardcore that liked it, but most people never really did accept it.
Most people didn't, no. Including a lot of the older musicians didn't accept it either.
Yeah, I have to admit to you, Ernie, that it never made a lot of sense to me. I know that's an overworked phrase. People use that with jazz, too. I don't understand it. But I never could quite catch the spirit of bebop myself. I apologize for that, but I make up for it by a love of the other kind of music here.
Okay.
What about Maynard Ferguson? I know you do arrangements for him even nowadays.
Well, I met Maynard back in the 50s after he had been with Stan Kenton, and he decided to get his own band. First, he started out in Hollywood. Then he decided to move to New York, and he decided to get his own band together in New York. And at that time, there was a jazz club in New York called Birdland, well known all over the world. And the owners of Birdland suggested to Maynard to get a band to bring the band down in Birdland, in conjunction with a record company too. I think it was RCA Victor, or one of its subsidiaries, you know. So they decided to call it Maynard Ferguson and the Birdland Dream Band. And that's how he started out, the Birdland Dream Band.
Is that a fact?
Right, and I was in the band, and guys like Al Korn, and let me see some more all-stars, Bud Johnson on tenor. Well, that's how I started, and that's when I started writing a few things for Maynard. And so over the years, every once in a while, he would call me, and I would, you know, write something for him.
I know he did a live album recently called Live at Jimmy's Place with Maynard Ferguson, and there's a number in it that you arranged called Stay Loose with Bruce.
Right.
Who is that name for? Who's Bruce?
His name is Bruce Johnson. He's a great baritone saxophonist. In fact, he lives in Connecticut, too. And since he was the soloist on this particular thing, they changed the name to Stay Loose with Bruce.
Oh, it's a change name. What was it before that?
Geller's Cellar. Then the next time it was Watch the Ford Go By, featuring Jimmy Ford on alto sax.
It's a pretty versatile number. Tommy Dorsey, you did a couple of arrangements for him. I remember a number called Peace Pipe. It seems to me that Tommy and Jimmy were playing together again.
That's
when
right.
They recorded that back in the 50s, shortly before they both passed on.
That's true.
Did you meet with Tommy?
Yes.
In putting that together?
That was a personal thing, too. Uh-huh. It was a personal involvement. And Tommy also had me to travel with the band sometimes, you know. Or either he would feel good and say, hey, Ernie, fly out to Chicago and hang out with me for a few days. And he'd send me a ticket, and I'd fly out, and I hear the band, and he takes me out, whining and dining, and
He was an extremely generous man, I understand.
He really was.
As long as he liked you, but I understand that if you were not on the good list, you were on a really bad list.
Forget it forever for him.
Did you know Jimmy very well?
Not very well. Even then, Jimmy was kind of sick. He was pretty sick then, and he was very quiet. And, I would go to the job, and he would be there on the bandstand with Tommy, but he was very quiet, and he would give me a smile, but I never got to know him, you know.
How about Clark Terry? Now, he's an old friend of yours, I know. You've played together for many, many years. How do you approach an arrangement for Clark Terry's band?
Well, I don't have to think about styles or clinging to one particular style or having to relate to another kind of style or whatever. I just go for myself then. Write anything that I feel, anything that I want to.
That's the nicest kind of work.
That is the nicest kind. I'm not restricted in any way, and Clark doesn't tell me anything, what to do or whatever, you know. So I think the things that I've done lately, the past few years for Clark, are more Ernie Wilkins than Count Basie or Harry James or Dizzy Gillespie. It's more my own personality and my own feelings and my own musical outlook on life.
tell me, Ernie, have you ever done an arrangement, finished the whole thing, and thought it was a pretty good piece of work and turned it over to a band leader who just didn't like it for some reason, didn't use it?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. All of them.
Oh, yeah.
And I've also done some things that I thought were going to turn out pretty good that I tore up, too, that I didn't like.
Is that right?
Of course. I think that's happened to all composers and arrangers. It must have happened to Beethoven and Mozart, too.
And Schubert, who didn't even get to finish one of them, I guess. Yeah. This is probably impossible to answer. Is there one arrangement that you can look at that you are most proud of?
Yes, it's one I just finished recently. I wrote a suite, and I performed it in Columbus, Ohio about a month ago. It hasn't been recorded yet. I'm trying to find a recording company. It's my latest work, and I recorded with a great organization, a band out in Columbus, Ohio that exists entirely on grants and contributions. And this particular band is made up of college students and college professors and working pros around Columbus. And I was commissioned by them, by the way, through the grant, particular grant, to write the suite for them. And I hope it's recorded soon. And I meant to tell you about this. I also dedicated to Duke. This is a suite to Duke Ellington.
What is it called?
Suite Duke Suite. S-W-E-E-T Duke S-U-I-T-E.
Isn't that beautiful? That's a great name. I like it already, and I haven't heard any of the music yet. How long will it run?
About 20 minutes, or maybe a half an hour. And I'm supposed to get a tape from them sometime soon.
I've got to toss out a couple of other names of people you've worked with. Quincy Jones, I think if there's a modern genius around, he certainly qualifies. He's in that club.
That's true. That's true. I remember when Quincy first came to New York, and first he joined Lionel Hampton's band, and I worked with him for a while, and he was about 19 years old. That's when I first met him. Then he settled in New York, and he and I became very good friends. I was like his big brother, you know. So we both became pretty active around New York and very busy. And later on, Quincy organized his own band, say in the late 50s, and even went overseas with the band. So he asked me to write a few things for him, his old buddy, his big brother, so I did. Mm. And those are the things that I wrote for Quincy, I feel, are some of the best things I've ever done. Because, Quincy gave me all the freedom in the world, too. I didn't have to write, Basie style or whatever. So I felt free to write anything that I wanted to for Quincy's band. And it really came off. I wrote four things for him, and they're four of my very favorites, all-time favorites.
Can you name the four? Do you recall the titles offhand?
Yes, I wrote one called Ghana. That was when Ghana, the Republic of Ghana, first gained its freedom, or whatever. That was an original composition. And another original composition I wrote called Everybody's Blues. Then I wrote one, an old bassist standard called Lester Leaps In.
Oh, I didn't realize that was one of yours.
Yes, and Cherokee, the old Dre Noble standard.
That's right.
I wrote an arrangement on that.
How about Buddy Rich?
Okay, Buddy Rich.
This is a whole new bug.
Well, my latest things for Buddy, I wrote some things for Buddy back in the late 50s and early 60s, too, that were recorded, I believe, on MRC, part of a Mercury Records. Mm-hmm. And I understand that they're going to be reissued. I don't know where they have been or not. But I've done some things lately for him. Two of them were recorded on Groove Merchant. And the name of the album is The Roar of 74. It has Buddy sitting in a sports car on the cover. Mm-hmm. And the two things that I wrote, that he recorded, the first one is called Senator Sam. Now, I guess you can imagine what...
I've got some ideas, yeah.
Senator
Irvin, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And the other one was Big Mac.
And the titles are great. I could never even come up with the titles if I could write the music. Oscar Peterson.
I did an album for Oscar in the middle 60s with a large orchestra, big band, and let's see now. Yeah, around the middle, around 64 or something like that. And at that time, Oscar had his own trio. You had Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen on drums, and I just surrounded them with a big band. And Oscar and I got together on what tunes he would do and whatever. So we did a couple of original things of his and several standards. And I believe that we were the first to record a tune that's overworked today. We were the first to record it instrumentally. It's called Here Comes That Rainy Day.
Oh, I think we were the first. Number. Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, I think he was the first to record it as a singer. But Oscar Peterson and I recorded it as an instrumental. And it was fun to do. You know, we had a lot of all-stars on that album, too. Clark Terry and, I can't name them. Nat Adderley, Roy Eldridge.
It's a shame you can't work with big names. You've worked with so many vocalists over the years, too. Running down a list here, there's Joe Williams, Billy Eckstein, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington, and my own personal favorite, Carmen McRae.
Yes, indeed. I love her. That was it was a great experience working with her because she's so musical. Well, so is Sarah Vaughan and so was Dinah Washington, you know. They all play piano also. You know, Dinah played piano, Sarah plays piano, Carmen plays piano. And they know so much about music that it was so easy to get with them, you know. No problems whatsoever.
I was going to ask an unfair question. Is it easier to write for any one of them than any other? I think when there's that much talent, though, it's a matter of their musicianship taking over.
It was easy for any of them, those ladies that I named. You know, no problems whatsoever.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are so laughable. Yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than gray? Is your mouth a little weak? Are you small? Well, don't you ever change a hair for me. No, not if you really care for me. Stay funny Valentine. Stay. Is your mouth a little weak when you open it to speak? Are you small? For me. is my Valentine's Day.
You've also done some work for Louis Belson, I see, who's a pretty talented drummer.
He? Yes, he is.
Yeah, and always has great bands.
Right.
Ernie, you've worked with just about everybody in the business, and for that I envy you, and I envy them, too, for having had somebody of your magnificent talent able to make these arrangements for them and to add your own particular sound in sections of the various bands. You are teaching now, as you mentioned, and you've settled down in Milford, Connecticut. Is this going to be home for a long time to come?
It looks like it will be. It certainly does. I have kind of fallen in love with Milford. And I'm not saying this because I'm here in Connecticut, but I have always liked the state of Connecticut since I've been living in the Northeast. And I'm glad to be here, really. And Milford is a sweet little town.
Do you have a family?
Yes, I do. My wife and two children.
Mm-hmm. How old are they?
The girl is 13, the boy is 10.
Do they enjoy living here?
Yes, they do.
And, of course, in Milford, you're close enough to New York City, which is, I guess, still the mecca of great
music. It is. I must keep my ties with New York.
Sure. Well, I know you have a tremendously busy schedule, and I can't tell you, after years of reading about you, what a pleasure it is to finally meet Ernie Wilkins personally, and I really appreciate your taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on a one-night stand with the big bands. Our location and studio engineer was Bob Chirego. This is Arnold Dean. Thank you.